This is a small discourse from the numerical discourses, the 8 and 4:14, the book of Purusha, and Sutta number 14 is called restraint. This is what I was saying yesterday about the idea of restraint in Buddhism. I was saying that it sounds in English as if you're doing using a lot of willpower and force, but actually it is not quite like that. This is what I want to point out now. The Pali word for restraint is sampada, and the restraint of the senses is called indriya sampada, or indriya sampada sila, which means the morality of the restraint of the senses. And this is an important part of this. So this passage here basically shows us how we should deal with the mind in a very broad sense, and how to overcome the problems in the mind, specifically how to overcome the two main defilements, sensual desire on the one hand, ill will on the other hand. These are the two main problems that block us in meditation practice. So how to do this? This is how this sutta goes. Mendicants, there are these four efforts. What for? The effort to restrain. The effort to restrain, the effort to give up, the effort to develop, and the effort to preserve. And one mendicant is the effort to restrain. When a mendicant sees the sight with their eyes, they don't get caught up in the feature and details. If the faculty of sight were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of sight and achieving its restraint. This is what you do. Yeah, makes sense? So, okay, I'll explain a bit more detail because it's not very obvious necessarily what's going on here, especially for those of you who have heard this for the first time. It is not very obvious. So you see the sight with the eye, which is pretty much all the time. The sense of sight is like the dominant sense for human beings. So much of the information we take in comes in through our eyes. So we see stuff all the time. Always coming in. And then the idea is, as it says here, you don't get caught up in the feature and details. What does that mean? Well, feature and details just means that it just means that when you see something, you can feel various aspects to things. Either it can be the whole sight or it can be a small part of the sight. It's just the idea that it refers to anything you see. The details, the whole picture, some aspects, whatever it is. That's really all it means when it talks about feature and details. So you can look at the person, or you can see a part of the person, or whatever. And then there's the idea of not getting caught up. What does that mean? And what that means is that you will, very often, when you see something, something comes into your mind from the outside, you will have two reactions to the things you see. Actually, three reactions, perhaps. One is you like it, And as soon as you like something, you walk in the city and you walk past a nice shop, they have some really nice food inside, and you can't get that food out of your mind. Especially if you're hungry, If you're just eating, it doesn't matter, but if you're hungry before, you see something really nice, and it gets stuck in your mind, and you get obsessed with getting something to eat, you can't stop until you sit down in the restaurant, and you kind of have that nice lunch or whatever. Anyone here has not had that kind of experience? If you haven't had that experience, I would say, wow, that's pretty, pretty awesome, pretty amazing. So everyone has these kind of experiences, And so much in life is about that. You see things and you get somehow caught up in that experience. It lingers in your mind. You can't really move on. And the memory of that thing is there. You see a person who you like or you don't like. The opposite is if you don't like, that's the other reaction. I said three reactions. You like, you don't like, or you are neutral about the things that you see. So whenever neutral is okay, but either being attracted or disliking is always a problem because it lingers in your mind when you do that. And of course, if it lingers in your mind, then you lose your mindfulness. And when you lose your mindfulness, it means you lose your ability to regulate your emotions or regulate your mind properly. It means you lose your ability to practice the Buddhist path. That's essentially what it means. So the idea is to avoid those strong reactions to the world around us. That's really all that this means. So you see someone, you think, oh, don't like this person. Actually, you change your attitude, you look at it differently. You see the cake or something in the shop, and you think, oh, that looks very nice. But you think, wait, I'll have my lunch later on anyway, so let's forget about it. Yeah, and you react to these things in a more skillful way. That food that you see in the shop is not such a big deal. Some of the main reactions are how we deal with people. That this is some of the most important things in life. So this is what this means. And if you don't get caught up in that way, if you're able to kind of have mindfulness regularly, it means that you flow through your ordinary life. You go with the flow, you can, when something new comes up, you can just go with that, and you see what's happening next, and you can, every instance, you're kind of with whatever is happening, and it enables you to react in an appropriate way at all times, because you have mindfulness, because you have clarity, because you have sampajanya, this clear comprehension or situational awareness. You know what is the appropriate way to react at any particular time. To be able to do that, you have to have mindfulness. You can't allow yourself to be caught up in this way. That's why it's ending. If the sight, faculty of sight, was left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion. You're either attracted or you are repelled by something. Desire and aversion would become overwhelming. And you want to avoid that because you want to have an even mind at all times if possible. For this reason, you practice the restraint. You protect the faculty of sight. You achieve its restraint. And this last part here is in some way the place that is the one that is most important because it shows you what you're supposed to do. So you protect the faculty of sight. What that means is that you have mindfulness to begin with, so you have mindfulness to begin with. So when you walk past that beautiful restaurant with the wonderful food inside, then you already have mindfulness, you know what's going on. If you come there to that restaurant and you haven't got any mindfulness because you've been doing something else, then the power of that input will be even more because you have no idea what's going on. It will completely overwhelm you. But if you arrive there and have mindfulness already, you will be able to see what's going on. Because you see that you are bound to give rise to some strong desire, you can actually turn in a different direction to remind yourself this desire is completely useless. I will have my lunch at the appropriate time or whatever, and that is the time I'm going to eat, so forget about that. It's completely irrelevant. No point in thinking about those things. So whatever it is that you think, you kind of not allow yourself to be sidetracked. So that mindfulness is the initial thing. This is why mindfulness matters so much. This is the early mindfulness. Remember, mindfulness comes in a large number of degrees. The mindfulness that you have when you meditate is supposed to be more powerful, because when you meditate, when you have clarity about the breath, it's a very precise kind of mindfulness. The deeper your meditation is, the more powerful the mindfulness. Some people think that mindfulness either is on or it's off. Actually, it's not quite like that. Because even though mindfulness is on, you may be aware roughly what's going on. It can be a bit blurry, not really sharp. Or it can be really, really sharp. And that's what happens when you come out of a deep state of meditation. So this we're talking about here is a very preliminary kind of mindfulness. Just enough mindfulness to know roughly what is going on in your mind. You can see desire is about to arise, aversion is about to arise. And especially in regard to people, this is very important. Especially in regard to aversion and ill will, it is very important. This is actually a very important point, because you may think that, if you're going to restrain yourself every time you walk past a restaurant from not thinking about the food, you may think I'm asking for the impossible now. So what do you think? Maybe? Maybe that's what you think. I would be surprised if some of you don't think that, because this is kind of really hard ask. Every time you see something nice, you walk in the street, you see lots of really nice cars here in Hong Kong, you drive around and see all these kind of fancy cars. Wow, that's a really fancy car. Even I see those fancy cars, Even after being a monk for 25 years, when you see a Ferrari, it's a Ferrari. Wow. So, but But that is not really the main issue, because these things are very difficult to restrain. You don't do one task whereas when you think about the food limit. Don't worry too much about that. I just brought it up as an example, not really because I expect you to achieve that. It's not the most important thing. The most important thing is the ill will. That is by far the most important thing, because it is so destructive, and it really takes away mindfulness, and also has very bad results in the future. It leads to so much suffering and so many problems. So that is what I really recommend you to work with. Work on the ill will side of things. Yeah? So have a mindfulness that informs you when you meet people, especially when you see people. That is why you need a lot of mindfulness, to see how you react to the people around you, especially when you react negatively. That's where you have to be careful. If you can do that much, if your restraint can achieve a reduction in your negative feelings around other people, wow, you've gone a long way already. That is maybe the easiest thing to do. And yet, that too takes a lot of commitment and perseverance. That is what the main thing should be. So when you're in your daily life, you have enough mindfulness, especially around people, to know how you react to people. When you see the potential, you get into range of someone, into close range of someone who you have had problems with in the past, your alert goes up. Okay, now I have to be really careful. Yeah? And then you use the kind of principles I was talking about before, seeing the good aspect, having compassion, sometimes just avoiding the person is the only way, because it's just too difficult. You can see that you're in a bad mood already because you kind of didn't get your time for your morning meditation or whatever it is. You're already in a bit of a bad mood. If you meet this person, you know there's going to be a problem. So you just walk a different route, and you you avoid them or whatever it is that you do. That's okay. Sometimes we have to be realistic. Being realistic is one of the most important things in this practice. So, not be too idealistic about what we can do. If you can do that much, it's wonderful. Restraining the desire for things is much more tricky, because desire, you don't have the feeling that anything is really wrong or bad with desire. And desire is not something that has the same problem to it. For that reason, it's much harder. It's also much more difficult also to think in such a way that the desires go down. In this case, it's more important to use like a long-term strategy that, you just reduce your general interest in the world over time. That will have a major impact. So focus on the anger, focus on the ill will, focus on the irritations in life. If you can do that much, you're going a long, long way already. So you have the mindfulness, and then it says you restrain it, and then the restraint happens precisely in this way. Not by force. Sometimes you have to use a little bit of force, because sometimes the emotions become too strong, you have to use a bit of force. But most of the time you use wisdom, the kind of wisdom I've just been talking about. Simple wisdom, but very, very powerful, to remind yourself of another way of looking at the situation. So, and then the same thing for the other senses. When you hear a sound with the ears, you smell an odor with the nose, you taste the flavor with the tongue, you feel a touch with the body. When you know a thought with the mind, you don't get caught up in the features and details. Even when you think, because thinking, just sitting in meditation, closing your eyes, sometimes you think about things that you may make you upset sometimes. You don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of mind were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, you practice the restraint, protecting the mind faculty and achieving its restraint. This is called the effort to restrain. That makes sense. Am I making sense here, or is it, makes sense? Okay, good. Some of you know, some of you look a bit perplexed, but that's okay. At least I'm sure you get the rough idea, and then you just have to try it out and see how it works. So that is the first one. That is probably the most important one. The second one, in many ways, is similar. I'll just go through this very quickly now, because we're running out of time a little bit. And one of mendicants is an effort to give up. The first one is to restrain. It means we avoid the problem in the first place. Now the problem has already arisen. If the problem has arisen, we have to give it up. It's when a mendicant does not tolerate a sexual, malicious, or harmful thought that's arisen, but gives it up, gets rid of it, eliminates it, and obliterates it. They don't tolerate any bad, unskillful qualities that have arisen, but give them up, get rid of them, eliminate them, and obliterate them. This is called an effort to give up. So here, you're already upset then. Yeah, something has upset you in your life, and then you have to try to give up that thought of upset. And this is again what is interesting about this. You will notice the words used here are pretty. Again, it sounds like a incredible amount of willpower. Yeah, you get rid of it, you eliminate it. Not only do you eliminate it, but you actually obliterate it. It sounds like you take a sledgehammer. That's what that sounds like. Take a sledgehammer and you kind of whack it and you kind of pulverize it and you obliterate it. But again, these things have to be understood in the right way. The reason why this is interesting is because if you want to obliterate something in the mind, the last thing you should do is to use willpower. It sounds counterintuitive, that's actually the case. When you look at one of my favorite sutras that deal with this particular topic, it's called the Dvaita-Vitakka Sutra, the two kinds of thought. Number 19 in the middle length sayings of the Buddha, the Majjhimanikaya. And the way the Buddha talks about overcoming is exactly the same bad thoughts as this. He talks about his own life. Yeah, this is how the Buddha himself overcame these things. He was human just like us, had the same kind of problems. The way he talks about it is all about wisdom. He says, these thoughts harm myself. Always myself first is the interesting thing. It harms others. It harms both myself and others. So this is using reflection, yeah? This is using thinking, wisdom. It harms me. Why can't I think about something which harms me? It's like taking a hammer and hitting my hand. Why do I take a hammer and hit my hand? It's not wise to do that, to stop hitting. If you really see how harmful anger is towards yourself, you would never get angry anymore. It's because we don't fully understand it. That's why we still get angry. And then you think, it leads to the ending of wisdom. If you want to be wise, you don't want to get angry because it destroys wisdom. It leads to problems. Agata, in this case, just means problems in general, all kind of issues, yeah, with other people or whatever. And it leads away from nibbana, which is the goal of spiritual practice. So this is how the Buddha does this. It's all about reflection. Yeah, the power of reflection I was talking about before. This is all about this power, how to use that to overcome these negative states of mind. And that is how you obliterate them. And the reason why this obliterates them, this is, I think, a very important point to understand about how the mind works. If you suppress the anger, if you hold it down, what happens is that, first of all, you haven't really eliminated it. What you have done is just holding it back because it's so unpleasant, you don't want to see the anger anymore. But after a while, two things happen. You get tired because you're using force to hold it down, so it's problematic. And as soon as you let go, it tends to bounce back again because you're just holding it down. Sometimes it does disappear, it's true, because you're holding it down and you get distracted, you think about something else, and then anger goes, but sometimes it just comes back again. So, if you want to obliterate something, suppression doesn't work. Suppression just tires you out, you lose your energy, and eventually it comes back again. So suppression is not the way to go. If you want to obliterate something, you have to use wisdom power. Because if you use wisdom, if you see that this is truly harmful, if you look at the person and you see the bad quality and you shift your sign to see the good qualities instead, or you have compassion, you actually change the reaction in your mind. And you don't get angry anymore because you're looking at the object in a different way. And it's very powerful. If you do this in the right way, suddenly the anger is gone, just like that. Completely gone. There's no residue left. It is no longer there, waiting to come out. It's actually gone completely. That's how we can obliterate this negative space of mind. So, it's an interesting, because it is interesting, because when you read this text, you might get the wrong idea. I think the Pali word for eliminate and obliterate here, they're just as a kind of as strong as they are in English. Anabhava karoti is about make it non-existent. Yeah? In other words, kind of annihilate it is the Pali word, I think, for this one. It's a very strong word. So this is how it is done. Yeah, use that wisdom power. Remind yourself the simple wisdom, yeah, about how to look at other people, remembering the good qualities, always having compassion, because people don't really understand that. They don't know what they're doing. They want to be happy, and they do things that make them miserable and suffering instead. It's kind of a bit sad, isn't it, that all the people in the world, everyone wants to be happy, and yet the vast majority of people do things that end up causing suffering for themselves and also for others. Okay, so that is the second right effort. These are the two most important ones, because these are the two that really purify you. And the last two, they are the right efforts on development and preserving. And these are the things that have to do with meditation practice. So the first two efforts are to purify yourself. And once you are purified to a certain extent, then come the right efforts about meditation practice. But instead of looking at that, let's come back to one of my favorite suttas, which I have mentioned before in passing, but I didn't really read it out. So if you go back one page, and on this one page back, you find a sutta called Making a Wish. And I'm not sure why it is in here, but it's there, so I might as well read it out. I'm not sure. I can't even remember putting it in there, but I must have done so. There it is. So this is a Making a Wish. This is one of the sutras I always tend to read out on any kind of meditation retreat, because it's such a positive sutta. And this is how it goes. Again, from the Numerical Discourses, A.N., Anguttara Nikaya, 10, tens, and chapter of tens, sutta number 2. Mendicants, an ethical person who has fulfilled ethical conduct, need not make a wish. May I have no regret. It is only natural that an ethical person has no regrets. When you have no regrets, you need not make a wish. May I feel joyful. It is only natural that joy springs up when you have no regrets. When you feel joy, you need not make a wish. May I experience rapture. It is only natural that rapture arises when you are joyful. When your mind is full of rapture, you may not make a wish. May my body become tranquil. It is only natural that your body becomes tranquil when your mind is full of rapture. When your body is tranquil, you need not make a wish. May I feel bliss. It is only natural to feel bliss when your body is tranquil. When you feel bliss, you need not make a wish. May my mind be immersed in samadhi. It is only natural for the mind to be immersed in samadhi when you feel bliss. When the mind is immersed in samadhi, you need not make a wish. May I truly know and see. It is only natural to truly know and see when your mind is immersed in samadhi. And then after that, because from there all the way up to the final freedom of the knowledge of vision at the very end there. I'm going to leave that out because that's probably far enough already. Yeah. So this is this path of meditation. Yeah, and you will notice here that it starts off with ethical conduct. And this is the sila. Yeah, and then you will notice that every step after that is automatically. It is natural. Yeah, it happens as a matter of nature. It's dhammaka, as I mentioned before. Yeah? So you don't actually need to do anything. Once the ethics is purified enough, then this path happens all by itself. Yeah? So this whole sequence happens. So if there is a problem here, the problem is at the very beginning, because if it is a natural sequence, it must be the first step that is problematic. That is what you haven't done enough of yet. So always come back to the first step. How can I purify myself more? What do I need to do to have more calm and peace in ordinary life? What do I need to do so that I have more contentment? I don't get upset so easily and all of these kind of things. How can I be more kind with the way I speak? Remember that ethics in Buddhism is not just about avoiding the bad, it's about deliberately doing the good. How can I speak kind words that go to the heart of other people? How can I be supportive and friendly to others? How can I have more compassion in the world? All of these things, yeah, build these things up. And as you do so, the path becomes automatic in this way. That is where the problem is. It always comes back to that. It's such an incredibly important thing to understand, because people often think that meditation is like a self, it stands on its own. Just, you know, you can get benefits of meditation even if you don't do anything else. But if you're really going to succeed in a meditation practice, this is how it works. And it says here, you need not make a wish, but really, and this is, again, where I disagree a little bit with Ajahn Sudhakar on this, the Pali is Na Chaitanaya Karaniya. It literally means not to be done by will, by Chaitanya. In other words, it cannot be done by will. It's not that it need not be done, it cannot be done by will. This is really the message of the Pali here. It's much stronger than this. So I don't know why, maybe he has just followed Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. It's dangerous to kind of disagree with these great authorities in the world. But I am, maybe I'm too arrogant, yeah? So I disagree with the greatest authorities, but I do. Actually, I've been a monk for 25 years. I think I have the right to disagree if I want to. So I disagree. And the Pali actually says that this cannot be done by an act of volition. So, again, yeah, you cannot will it. It has to happen naturally. And this is one of the reasons that you say when you meditate, don't use willpower. Allow things to happen. Sit down, allow your mind to become peaceful. Don't grab hold of the breath. If you grab hold of the breath straight away, you are going against this natural path. Yeah, allow things to happen. Enjoy the peace. Set up a positive mindset. That's part of sila. Set up a positive mindset. You feel good about yourself. You feel good about the environment. You have a sense of kindness and care in your heart. A sense of compassion for everyone. And when you have that, that is when this happens. And then what happens is this amazing path. Yeah, when you look at this, it is so powerful. It's so beautiful. All the way, you have no regrets. Well, that's kind of nice. But that's, you know, just the beginning. And then you have joy. Then you have rapture. What's the difference? Well, rapture is more joy than joy. It's just even more happiness. Yeah. Then you have tranquility, which is even better again. It doesn't mean that your rapture disappears. It just means that it becomes more refined, so you feel tranquil. Then from that comes an even more powerful happiness, it says here. Yeah, the bliss, it says here, the sukha. From that comes the real samadhi. This is why it is bliss upon bliss upon bliss. One bliss more powerful than the next one. Sometimes you wonder, sometimes people say, oh, I had some rapture in my meditation. Have I gone to jhana? No, you haven't. You're just starting out. This is just the beginning of the happiness. There's so much happiness on this path. It will blow your mind. This is what this is saying. What happiness after another one? Until, as Ajahn Brahm says, you don't think you can take it anymore. You feel like a nuclear reactor full of bliss. That's what you feel like. That's what Ajahn Brahm said that in one of his talks many years ago. I remember that. You have so much energy, and you're so blissful, and you're so bright. This is what is in front of us. But the trick is, get it right at the beginning. Practice all the initial things. And then, this is your inheritance from the Buddha himself. Every one of us has a right to this, if you like, as long as we practice the path in the right way. So, I'm not going to say anything much more. There was some tables at the back there, and these tables are just there to show you the parallel between all these various teaching things. There's a lot of parallel there. You have the sequence of dependent liberation, which is the sequence I've just been reading out. It's very closely related to the awakening practice. It's very closely related to the sequence of mindfulness of breathing. And it's also very closely related to the six recollections. These are different ways of describing meditation in the suttas, but they're all very closely related to each other. It's always the same process, going via bliss, via samadhi, and then eventually seeing things according to reality in this way. So, that is really all I want to say on this retreat. I wish you all the best of luck. Actually, you don't need luck, you need to be wise. Yeah? Be wise. Don't rely on luck. If you rely on luck, you're going to have a problem. Be wise instead. How can you be wise? The way you can be wise is to remember, come back to this teaching. Allow yourself to be inspired by the word of the Buddha. And listen to good teachings again and again and again. And after a while, this time to have impact on you. Have more and more impact as you go on. If you feel that you lose your way a little bit, you lose your inspiration and energy, it's because you have lost that feel for the word of the Buddha, which is so beautiful, come back to it again and again and again. Come back to a little meditation retreat. So the beauty of this retreat we've had here, it's a nice balance between teaching and also a beautiful setting, a nice company, enough time to do some meditation practice. So, but meditation retreats come in a variety of different types and things with different teachers, and so try out a few different things, and then see how you go along. But come back to the teachings again and again and again. Remember the rain on the top of the mountain. As long as it rains on the top of the mountain, eventually those rivers, those streams, eventually that water will have to reach the ocean. Yeah? One day you too will be there. Okay, so that is it for this morning. We have been told by Della yesterday that please come out for 2 o'clock, so we'll come back at 2 o'clock again, so we don't have so much kind of time in between. And then we will do a bit of meta meditation, a bit more Q&A towards the end, and we'll finish it off a couple of hours after that, see how things go. So again, have a nice lunch, and we'll see you at 2 o'clock.
So.